Welcome everyone to the teleclass, Personal Hygiene Measures to Prevent Transmission of Upper Respiratory Infections and Influenza. My name is Paul Weber, and on behalf of my colleague, Dr. Syed Sattar, I will again say welcome. We are honored that you have joined us. And although the topic today is very current and very popular, I suspect that the reason many of you are listening is specifically to hear what our faculty has to say about it. Dr. Elaine Larson is an institution in infection control and patient safety research. Her publications and lectures really form the cornerstone of practice for ICPs worldwide. At Columbia University, she is Professor of Pharmaceutical and Therapeutic Research, Associate Dean for Research for the School of Nursing, Professor of Epidemiology. She is the editor for the American Journal of Infection Control, and much more that I can say, certainly. She is a very helpful person, and I'm very grateful for all the ways that she has supported this program and me. Also very helpful and very supportive are our corporate sponsors. Deb Canada and the Deb Group Worldwide are sponsoring this teleclass. As you probably already know, teleclass education is run on a not-for-profit basis. And with the help of companies like Deb, we can provide this service to you at a very affordable cost, and in fact at no cost whatsoever to our colleagues in developing nations. Thanks very much to our colleagues at Deb Canada. So to present the teleclass, Personal Hygiene Measures to Prevent Transmission of URIs and Influenza from New York, New York, I am pleased to present Dr. Elaine Larson. Elaine.
Hello to all my friends out there. I want to give you a little bit of background on why I want to talk about personal hygiene measures specifically related to URIs and flu, because of course some of you know that I do general work on hand hygiene, but why this particular topic? Well, as you know, there's a huge amount of lay press about a possible impending pandemic with the new avian flu, and there are several reasons why we need to look at a variety of ways to reduce transmission. We could certainly say that for seasonal flu, which comes every year, seasonal flu comes every year. Pandemic flu doesn't come that often. In fact, there have only been 3 or 4 pandemics in the world in this century. So when a pandemic does occur, it's with a strain that is different enough from the strains that are circulating in the seasonal flu that the vaccine that is being used for seasonal flu no longer works or is not very efficacious. So certainly the main major line of defense against flu obviously is vaccination, but never can be guaranteed that the vaccine that is available each season will in fact be protective against a new strain, a pandemic strain of flu. In addition, most vaccines, and certainly the flu vaccine, is not 100% efficacious. And it looks like this year, I'm not sure, I think it's around 80-85%, but we won't really know for a while, at least in North America, certainly in the U.S., the seasonal flu really hasn't gotten underway very much. There are reported cases. For example, I know in New York State we have 5 or 6 now, and we've actually seen our first 2 cases of flu in nurses in our hospital. But it appears that it will probably peak this year in February or March, so we won't really know about efficacy of this year's vaccine. So that's one reason why we need to talk about other measures to reduce risk of URIs and flu. There's a couple other reasons. One is that, as you know, masks have been one of the historical ways to prevent droplet transmission, especially during flu epidemics and especially in the Asian world and other parts of the country. But believe it or not, there have not been any definitive studies to demonstrate whether or not face masks are actually that effective. Nobody really knows. Theoretically, they make sense. They probably reduces some transmission, but the Institute of Medicine just published a report on, in case there is a flu epidemic, What are we going to do about masks in the community? Are we going to recommend them? And if we are, can they be reused, et cetera? And so one thing we know is that there definitely are not going to be enough N95 masks for the community. So if there are masks used during seasonal flu or a pandemic, it will likely be regular surgical masks, and even surgical masks may be in short supply. So that's another reason for other ways to prevent flu. Finally, as you probably know, we read all the time in the lay press about the flu, and it's a little bit scary. There are headlines all the time. So I just published a paper this month in a journal called Public Health Nursing, if you're interested, and it's called Warned But Not Well Prepared, or something like that. Anyway, the contention is that the public knows about the flu. They're concerned, but they don't really know what they can do as individuals in the community to reduce their own risk. So what we're going to do in this telecast is to talk about personal hygiene that can be done, and I'm focusing primarily in the community because you will have people in your communities asking you, as experts in infection prevention, what can I do personally to reduce my risk of transmission of the flu? So let's go to the second slide just to briefly review the principles of transmission, and then what I'm going to do is talk about the research related to hand hygiene, but specifically related to the evidence of hand hygiene in reducing transmission of respiratory infections. Then I'm going to briefly touch a little bit on masks and other things that have been shown in the literature to possibly be effective in reducing transmission. So just to review briefly, influenza viruses, as you know, are highly contagious. They actually are not as contagious as SARS, but that's about as comparable as any other thing, slightly less contagious than SARS, transmitted easily by large particle droplets, and also probably by direct contact. And we know that it's transmitted not only by droplet, but also by contact, primarily because of the research that's been done with rhinovirus. And of course, as you know, rhinoviruses, there are about 200 varieties of rhinoviruses that cause the cold, the common cold. And there were studies done by Gwaltney and others in the 60s, 70s, 80s that demonstrate that the rhinovirus is readily transmitted on hands, probably more so even than through the air. So we're assuming that flu is transmitted both through large droplet and also through direct contact. I do also want to say that this extensive review of the literature that I'm going to present to you was done in collaboration with Dr. Allison Aiello, who's at the University of Michigan. Anyway, transmission of the flu requires close contact and probably within 1 meter or 3 feet or less, although there is a recent study that showed that the virus can be transmitted through the air up to possibly 6 feet. So generally when we advise people about spatial separation from people who have URIs, we say stay no closer than 3 feet, and that's probably generally safe. Now, in the next slide, what's the evidence? Let's review that, and in the next slide, I'm going to talk about some trials of hand washing and respiratory viral infections, and the references are either on the slides or they're easy to look up. I did not provide a formal reference list. If you are dying to get one of these, certainly let me or Paul know, and I can get the references to you. This is a study, the first one in Pakistan by Steve Luby and his colleagues, that was published 2 years ago in Lancet. It was a large study. It was 25 neighborhoods that were randomized to a hand-washing intervention, and 11 of the neighborhoods served as a control group. It was a one-year trial, and they looked at a couple of outcomes. They were studying children who were less than 25 years of age. And what they found is that in the neighborhoods who had the hand-washing intervention, there was a 50% reduction in pneumonia from all causes. This is not just viral pneumonia. It could be bacterial as well. But the point is that it reduced respiratory infections, pneumonia, by 50%, and that was statistically significant. However, there were no differences in the rates of pneumonia whether the neighborhoods used a plain soap, which was just a non-antimicrobial soap, or an antibacterial soap. So there was value to the hand washing, but there was no added value to an antibacterial product. On the next slide, I'm just going to review six studies now from child care centers that had three or more children in daycare homes. The earliest one was in 1990. This was 24 daycare homes at which were randomized to using an alcohol hand sanitizer. Now, this was 16, 17 years ago, way before the CDC guideline. This is before alcohol hand sanitizers were actually recommended by CDC. But this was, the intervention was providing the daycare providers with hand sanitizer, diapering pads, like the blue pads we use in the hospital, the disposable pads, and gloves for diapering. In this study, there were no significant differences in symptoms of URIs among the children. Now, we think, I was actually involved in this study, Dr. Butts was one of my postdocs, and we think that the reason was because we didn't do any intervention with the children. And when the children, as you know, have runny nose and, you know, are running around and playing with toys and stuff, they are not particularly well-versed and well-trained in personal hygiene when they're preschoolers. So we think that the problem with our study was that we did not do anything to change the behavior, educate the kids to cough in their shoulder or to provide them with any kind of hand hygiene. So it may be that that could have worked, except that the children certainly were sharing toys, etc. The second study in child care centers was published in 1996, and it took place in a school for children with Down syndrome. The intervention was environmental cleaning, particularly toys. So actually, this didn't have to do with hand hygiene specifically, but they found a decrease in URIs. You can see the amount. It was not statistically significant, but it certainly was a decrease. On the next slide, the next two studies, one was in 1997 in two child care centers. The intervention was an educational program for the staff and the children on hand hygiene and germs, how are germs spread, etc. In this study, they did demonstrate a statistically significant reduction in upper respiratory infections within the intervention group. And then the next study in 1999 was a large study in 52 daycare centers. This intervention was a larger hygiene program, just to generally improve hygiene. And in addition, they took cultures of the hands and did coliform counts on the hands. And they found a reduced rate of upper respiratory infections. What you can see is the relative risk was 0.8, which means that the children in the intervention program had a 20% reduction in the risk of URIs as compared with those who did not. And you can see the 95% confidence intervals. Just to remind you, and I apologize because I'm sure you mostly know this, but if the confidence intervals include one, that means that it's not statistically significant. But as you can see, the 95% confidence intervals were from 0.68 to 0.93, which demonstrated a significant protective effect of the hygiene program against URIs. And then the last two on the next slide, studies in child care centers. One was by Roberts. This was an Australian study in 23 large child care centers. The intervention was hand washing and also aseptic nose wiping. That is, not just using a Kleenex that can soak through, but training people to wipe the noses aseptically. And I think this was the one where they actually had a plastic wrap around the Kleenex so that you could just wipe the nose and then it would already be in plastic and you could discard it without contaminating your hands. Anyway, they showed, again, a statistically significant rate of URIs among the younger children. And then the last study was in Finland, 60 child care centers. Intervention, again, it was hand washing, environmental cleaning, and washing of toys and linen. And they showed, again, a significant reduction, about a fourth fewer upper respiratory infections, particularly, again, in the younger children. It's not surprising that a lot of these are showing significant impact only in the younger age children because, obviously, as you get older, you develop antibodies and resistance to more kinds of agents which are causing URIs. Again, these are not specifically for flu, but they are for a variety of causes of URIs. In the next two slides, I just want to go over with you six studies that we found that have been conducted in schools, usually elementary schools. The first one was in one school by Master and others, and the intervention was scheduled hand washing throughout the day. And in this study, they showed no significant difference in absenteeism in the children related to upper respiratory infections. Now, we've been involved in sort of thinking about and planning a couple of interventions in schools. And one of the big problems, of course, is that it's very difficult with hand washing to actually implement that in a school classroom because let's say that there are 25 children or 20 children in a classroom. And to have hand washing when there's only one sink, you have to line everybody up. And frankly, the curriculum simply doesn't have time. It's just not feasible or practical to have that kind of an intervention in many schools. That's why some of the newer products, the waterless products, are more practical in schools because you don't have to line children up at a sink and take a lot of time out of the teaching day. So the next few studies were actually more feasible, more practical. One of them was a one-school crossover design, that is where they studied in one school the rates of URIs before the intervention and then after the intervention. The intervention was a rinse-free, waterless hand hygiene product with benzalkonium in it, and they showed a statistically significant reduction in URIs by 30% over in the first crossover, and then they did a second crossover and a highly significant 76% reduction in URIs. The next one by Hammond was in 16 schools. In this one, what they used, instead of hand washing, they used an alcohol hand product, and they again showed a almost 20% reduction in absenteeism among the school children due to URIs. And the next slide shows the other three studies that we found that were done in schools. By the way, this literature review was done for four decades, from the 1980s through 2006. So this is all we found in the literature. It's likely we could have missed something, but we worked hard to find all the research that there was on personal hygiene and URIs. This next one by White was in three schools, again, the benzalkonium hand hygiene product, a waterless product, and showed a reduction in infection, not just URIs, but various infections, absenteeism by 33%. Then five-school study in 2002, again, a 50% reduction in absenteeism. And finally, in 2004, in a single school, a 43% reduction in absences. Now, these six studies taken together are pretty impressive, because it's not that easy to implement a study in the public schools, and most of these were done in public schools. As you see, a lot of them were fairly big with a number of schools involved. So the studies in schools, and most of them, their outcome was absenteeism due to URIs, is pretty impressive. Now, on the next slide, I just wanted to summarize some studies, three studies that were done in other settings, not daycare centers and not schools, public schools. And these are the only three we found in other settings. The first one was in a senior daycare center, and the intervention there, again, was an alcohol hand hygiene product. they found no significant difference in URI rates after the intervention. And I can't comment, I don't recall how big this study was. I don't know if their lack of significance could be because the intervention didn't work, or it could have been an issue of a small sample size. And the next two were actually in four college dormitories, and these studies were in using the alcohol hand hygiene product. And again, what you see is significant reduction in URI symptoms and in absences from class, from college classes, related to upper respiratory infection. Again, fairly impressive. And in general, rather consistent. Then we found only two studies that have actually been done in a home setting. One of them was a study that I think I reported on in a previous webcast, but this was one that was published in the Annals of Internal Medicine a couple of years ago in 238 households. What we were doing is comparing in this randomized blinded clinical trial the use of antibacterial cleaning and hand hygiene products compared to non-antibacterial products. So there wasn't really a control group because you can't tell people not to clean and not to wash their hands. But we found no significant difference in upper respiratory symptoms in either the antibacterial or the non-antibacterial group. In this study, we did not use alcohol hand hygiene. We used regular hand washing. And then there was a very nice study by Santora and others in Boston, published in 2005, I believe it was in Pediatrics. It was a very good study. You might want to have a look at it. In 292 homes in which they had a child who was in daycare, and they were actually kind of looking at sort of the transmission between of infections between homes and daycare settings. This was an intervention study using alcohol hand hygiene, and what they found was a 40% reduction in absences to daycare from illness when they were using the alcohol hand hygiene product. Now, the next slide just summarizes a couple of these studies to show that the Koch study, Falsey study, and the Sandora study actually were not statistically significant specifically for upper respiratory infections. They were significant in general, except for the Falsey study. The White study, the third bar over, was statistically significant. So this is just another way to look at the percent reduction in URIs with these various studies. So they ranged from 3% to 20% reduction, but three of these four studies were not statistically significant, so they could have occurred by chance. This was the studies with alcohol-based hand sanitizer only. The next slide now is just a summary from these studies, and actually it looks like to some extent the results are equivocal. They're not consistent by any means, but they certainly are promising. And it's hard to know whether, as I said with a couple of the studies, whether the lack of significance could be due to the level of adherence to the intervention, or it could be due to the fact that the intervention, i.e. the hand hygiene intervention, only addressed one of the two major modes of URI transmission. As I said before, it's direct contact, but it's also definitely droplet spread, and hand hygiene is not going to take care of the droplet spread. So this could be a couple of reasons why interventions may not have worked, or they might not be effective. But effective practices definitely need to target both modes of transmission, the hand sanitizer for direct contact and respiratory etiquette for droplet spread. On the next slide then, I've tried to summarize the measures that look the most promising for targeting the direct contact spread of URIs, and that is using the alcohol-based formulations. These are, as you know, fast-acting and broad-spectrum. They have excellent microbicidal characteristics, including excellent activity against influenza and the other respiratory viruses. Nothing kills everything, but in general, alcohol is pretty good against most viruses that are respiratory. There's also, as we've discussed before, lack of the emergence of resistance with alcohol products, and there I'm referring to the fact that some of the soaps that contain triclosan have the theoretical risk of possibly increasing the risk of resistance to antiseptics and maybe even possibly antibiotics. But there is no such known mechanism with alcohol. So we don't have to worry about recommending the products to the community and to the public because there is no theoretical or real evidence of any emergence of resistance. Another reason why these products can be useful in the community is obviously because it's even more of a challenge in the community and in households to always have running water and clean towels available, because if families are using cloth towels to dry their hands, which most of us do because we're all sharing our same germs anyway, but if somebody in the family has the flu or a URI, the virus obviously can live on the cloth towels. So certainly it's better to recommend either an alcohol hand sanitizer when somebody has the flu or recommend that they use paper towels and discard them, not use cloth towels. Okay, on the next slide, a couple of other things from the literature that we found that do look like they are promising for the prevention of direct contact transmission of URIs. And the one thing I mentioned that was in one of the studies was using aseptic nose wiping, that is a plastic piece of like saran wrap or other, I don't know what brands, plastic wrap or even wax paper around a tissue and then throwing it away, because obviously tissues are extremely absorbent. Now I know that there are some tissues now available on the market that claim to have antimicrobial activity. I can't comment on those because I haven't studied them myself, but I know that there are some out there. In many, many places, those aren't going to be available anyway, so it makes sense to, people need to be aware when someone in the household or daycare providers or whoever, when someone has a cold, it's not enough to just put a tissue up to their nose, especially with children, but it's better to have it wrapped in plastic. And then obviously with kids, frequent washing of toys and other objects, because it's hard to sanitize many of the toys that kids play with. So it's nice if they're washable or if you can wipe them off with an alcohol pledget or something. And if for daycare providers, I would definitely recommend having some alcohol pledgets around or some wipes so that they can wipe off hard surface toys and things like that. And then obviously not going to work when we're sick. And I know that our work ethic, certainly in North America and around, I'm sure, in a lot of places, we feel that our bosses will think that we might not be doing the best we can if we don't come to work with a cold. And so we come to work with colds, and we're miserable, and everybody around us is backing off. But we need to make it okay for the public and in our culture to stay home when they're sick, because in the long run, economically, that's probably better than going to work and contaminating people that you work with. On the next slide, I just want to focus briefly on some of the common sense things that can be done to prevent droplet spread. Now, I do want to acknowledge that a lot of the things that we're talking about, you already know, they're common sense, etc. But honestly, when I talk to people in the community and in the public, some of this, it lends a lot of credibility to the message that you're giving when you, as an infection control and prevention professional, say these things. They may have heard them, they may have read them, but they will listen to you, and you can have a very positive impact on the community spread of transmission of URIs. So obviously, in terms of coughing or sneezing, use single-use handkerchiefs or paper tissues, not a cloth handkerchief like a lot of, particularly men, seems to me, like to have a handkerchief in their pocket, and they use it and stick it back in their pocket back and forth. It's really gross, as you know, and not a good idea. So when people have URIs, we need to tell them not to use cloth handkerchiefs. And then cough etiquette, coughing into your upper arm. And I know a lot of schools are teaching children this, honestly, no research has been done about this, but it makes a lot of sense that if you cough into your hand, we know from rhinovirus transmission that you're going to transmit that when you touch somebody else. So that's the logic behind cough etiquette, where you cough into your shoulder or your elbow or whatever. And then keeping persons with respiratory infections at a distance greater than a meter or 3 feet. Now, I have a hard time when I'm talking to people in the community who have a spouse, for example, who has the flu, and they say, well, what about sleeping with each other? The problem is that a lot of people simply don't have another room. The people that I work with in the New York Upper Manhattan community, the average number of people per household is 4.5 in one bedroom. So you can't tell people that they can't sleep together, but you can certainly encourage them, if possible, to maybe try to sleep on the couch or somewhere else, or stay away if somebody's really infectious with a URI. Now, CDC's definition of the flu, as you probably know, the clinical definition of influenza-like sickness is a fever over 100 and a cough or a sore throat without any other known cause. That is the CDC definition of an influenza-like illness. And when people have those symptoms, fever plus cough or sore throat, particularly if they're an adult, then they should be treated as if they may have the flu. Now, I'm not going to say too much about mask or eye protection because, as I said, there's essentially no research on that. But people, if in the case of a pandemic, people will want to wear masks, and if they do, then we need to provide them with information on how to wear them safely. And there's a couple of things that we can say about that. One thing is that obviously the disposable ones are much, much better than the cloth ones. We still see the cloth ones used a lot in Asia, but the Institute of Medicine actually has on their website a publication that can actually instruct the public in how to make homemade masks out of old T-shirt material and so forth. So that may be an option when people can't buy disposable masks, etc. But we also need to make sure that they know that they can't wear them all day. They're not going to work all day. They need to wear them when they're in close contact, i.e., less than a meter from somebody with flu-like symptoms. And then after they're away from that person, they can discard the mask in the same antiseptic or aseptic way, that is, with hand cleaning afterwards, and wash them if they're using the cloth types. I did also want to mention, because we hear all the time on the next slide about herbs and vitamins and natural ways to prevent the colds and the flu or to reduce the symptoms, etc., I did a really extensive review of the literature on evidence for any efficacy of these things, these five things that are listed on this next slide, to see if there was efficacy for prevention of URIs, colds, or the flu. Now, I didn't look to see if they reduced the amount of time that you had symptoms or reduced the symptomatology, but let me tell you that vitamin C, vitamin E, echinacea, and zinc, which are used all the time by people in the community. In fact, my son takes echinacea all the time, less so now that I've shown him the research. But there is no evidence whatsoever that any of these things can prevent getting a cold or the flu. There may be some that it may reduce the symptoms, but no evidence at all that it prevents transmission. Ginseng, on the other hand, ironically, not ironically, does show some promise in a very large body of literature. And it was actually a surprise to me to see that there have been some really nice studies in a variety of populations, including the elderly and gay men and children, etc., that ginseng may actually have some therapeutic effects and perhaps even preventing your risk of URIs. But that's all I can say about it now. I'm not an expert in this area, but it does show some promise, and you might be interested in looking at some of that. The next slide just shows some of the educational materials that are available free online. What I did was I just clicked on various websites, the CDC, the Lung Association, and various things. These materials actually have to do with hand hygiene, and they're quite readily available, and a number of them, I just picked a few, both in Spanish and in English. I didn't see any other languages, but I'm sure that those of you in Canada and other places will be able to find some nice things like this as well. And these can be very useful to you to give to people. They don't, most of them don't cost money, and they're attractive, and they deal with things from how to wash your hands, how to use alcohol hand sanitizers, etc. Oh, by the way, there are also a lot of good things on the web that are available for free about why antibiotics don't work for the flu and for URIs. What we've found in our community is that many, many people expect and obtain antibiotics for colds and the flu. And they obtain them either from a care provider by prescription, or they get them across the border in other ways. So there are really good educational materials available for free on when an antibiotic is useful, when it's not useful. And I think that one of the major challenges for us for reducing the global problem of antimicrobial resistance around the world is to educate the public on when is the proper time to use an antibiotic and why they don't work for viral infections. So I strongly recommend that you have a look at some of those. Now the droplet spread education is the same. There's education on how you cover your cough, how you discard things, how you put on a mask. And again, I found them in just a few minutes in Spanish and English. In Canada, you'll probably find them in French and in other countries as well. So these are readily available, and I recommend looking on the web before you try to create any of your own educational material, because, as you know, creating effective messages, educational messages, is actually a skill in itself. And a lot of these things that are available from groups that have hired educational experts to do it. So they're pretty good. And we've had some of these reviewed by focus groups in different strata and groups in the population. And generally what we do is if we want something for a particular group, like in our case, newly immigrated Latinos, we actually form a community group of those people to look through the materials and pick out what they think is the most relevant or appropriate for their group. Now, in the next slide, I just wanted to tell you about a study that we're doing called the STUFFY trial, which stands for Stopping URIs and Flu in the Family. And let me give you a little background on that, and maybe in a future thing I can tell you the results of that. But the reason for this is because the CDC was given some money by Congress to try to do some research to find out what were non-pharmaceutical interventions that might work in case we have a pandemic. So they sent out a request for applications for non-pharmaceutical interventions to prevent the flu. They funded actually 8 projects around the world. One of them is in New Zealand, and that one is related to preventing the flu transmission on airplanes. One is in Hong Kong, and that one is preventing transmission in the homes. And then there are several others around the U.S. that are either in college dormitories. There's 2 of those in dorms. There's one that's looking at school closures and the impact of school closure on flu transmission. And then our study is the second study, besides the one in Hong Kong, that's looking at transmission interventions in the home. So I just want to go through this a little bit. And the next slide shows our aims, which are to compare the impact of 3 household-level interventions on 6 outcomes. And I'll tell you what those outcomes are. And the intervention groups I'll show you in a minute are either education, everybody gets a little bit of education, education plus alcohol, hand sanitizer for hands, and then the hand sanitizer and the face masks is another group. The study outcomes in the next slide are the incidence and types or strains of virologically confirmed influenza. So we actually are taking nasopharyngeal cultures. If people have the symptoms that I mentioned of influenza-like illness, that is a fever and a cough or a sore throat without any other known cause. We're also looking at rates of symptoms of flu and viral URIs. We're looking at the number of secondary cases that are generated by a single infected person. In other words, what's the transmission rate? We're looking at antibiotic use practices for symptoms of flu, because one of the things we want to do is to reduce the inappropriate use of antibiotics. Then we're looking at knowledge of prevention strategies and rates of vaccine. On the next slide, just for your information, this is a report from CDC. This is the latest data that we have from 2003. This is the rates of influenza vaccination in the U.S. for recommended high-risk groups. So among those people age 65 or more, these are the high-risk groups on the left-hand column, and then the rates of influenza vaccination in the U.S. And I apologize that I don't know the rates in other countries, but 65% of those over 65 in 2003 actually were vaccinated. It's worse with persons with high-risk conditions, such as heart disease or emphysema. You can see the range of rates, but it's well less than 50%. Pregnant women, very low, and that's a fairly new recommendation for influenza vaccine in the U.S., and so the rates are quite low. Health care professionals, 40% were vaccinated in 2003. And you've probably seen a lot of literature in a lot of journals about how we can get healthcare professionals to get vaccinated. And one of the ways that we're doing it now, and probably a lot of you are doing it, is that we're requiring every healthcare professional who works in our hospital to sign a declination statement. In other words, if they're not willing to get vaccinated, they have to sign a statement they're not willing, and otherwise they have to get vaccinated. So our rates are a lot better. They're almost double this year. They're still not very good, but they're double what they have been. And it looks like this is probably one of the most effective ways to have an impact on the rates of vaccination among healthcare providers. Then again, you can see among household contacts of high-risk persons, the rates are fairly low. And a fairly new recommendation, which has been expanded since 2003, is for children age 6 months to 2 years, and we don't know the data on that, how many of them are going to be vaccinated. But you probably have seen campaigns. I know that the National Foundation for Infectious Diseases has had a major mass media campaign about getting your children vaccinated, and there are some really nice posters and some TV ads. They have spent a lot of money that's been funded by, fortunately, industry, to give a mass media campaign to get people immunized. The next slide just shows our counts from the study that I just mentioned to you, and I have shown this before. In our clinical trial of plain soap versus antimicrobial soap, these are just the log counts, the bacterial counts, and I'll just walk through it with you. On the vertical axis is the log counts. So 5.8 is what it's like, 800,000 bacteria per hand. The red bar is antimicrobial soap. The blue bar is the plain soap. And you can see at baseline, before and after hand hygiene, and then after a year, the pre-1 year and post-hand hygiene, there was no significant difference at all in the counts on the hands between the antibacterial soap or the plain soap. Now, again, we don't know if this result is the same for viruses, but based on Steve Luby's study, the Pakistani study, which I showed you in one of the early slides, he showed the same thing, that there was no difference in pneumonia rates between those who used a plain soap or an antibacterial soap. So while hand washing may be useful, there isn't any evidence that antibacterial soap is any better than plain soap. And for URIs, the alcohols look more promising than hand washing anyway. The next slide just shows the results again from our previous study. And look, if you will, at the adjusted rates in the far right column. And for these four respiratory symptoms, fever, sore throat, runny nose, and cough, what you can see, the RR stands for relative risk. But the important thing is, as I mentioned before, that if the 95% confidence intervals include one, that means that this could have easily occurred by chance. So you see that the p-value, all of those p-values are greater than 0.05, which means they were not statistically significant. What that means is that for any individual upper respiratory symptom, there was no significant difference in the rates of these symptoms in our study between antibacterial soap and plain soap. The next slide just shows the theoretical or the conceptual model that we're using for our intervention trial. We're trying to target our educational material and our interventions to three kinds of factors, one being predisposing factors, that is, what are your attitudes and beliefs about transmission and about viral infections and the flu. Enabling factors are, do I have the right products, do I know how to use them, etc. And reinforcing factors are, you know, do my colleagues, my mother, the healthcare providers whose advice I value, do they reinforce that this is something I should do? So we've tried to target our interventions for those three kinds of factors. And what we hope is that we will have an impact on behavior and lifestyle, ultimately on antibiotic use and reduced resistance and hopefully reduced viral URIs. Our design is on the next slide. We are trying to recruit, we're about halfway through now, 450 households. They will be randomized, they are being randomized right now, to either the education only, which is like our control group, the alcohol hand hygiene group, and the alcohol plus face masks groups. And then we're following up their symptoms for 15 months, hopefully through two seasons of the flu, starting with this season and going through the next year's season as well. The next slide just shows a little bit more about how our interventions relate to either predisposing factors, enabling factors, or reinforcing factors. It shows the link between our theoretical framework, if you will, and our interventions. Our setting on the next slide is in northern Manhattan, and in this neighborhood, we have about 80% Hispanics, half of whom are born outside the U.S. Generally, they are lower to middle income, often without health insurance. And as I mentioned, the average household has 4.5 people per one-bedroom apartment. There isn't really a half person in any household, but that's the average. And on our initial home visit, then, we're administering questionnaires about what they know about the flu, what they normally do for the flu, what they normally do in terms of practices. We're orienting them to their. And then in terms of data collection on the next slide, we're providing them with a toll-free number to call in every day electronically to report symptoms, and then we're visiting them every couple of months. The next slide just shows you our algorithm for how we're screening people who have influenza-like symptoms and the kinds of tests that we're doing for influenza, just for your information. And then that's basically it, more to come. We hope that this study will contribute to our knowledge about what actual measures, that is the hand sanitizer and the masks, if they will be efficacious in preventing transmission of URIs and flu in the household.
Thank you very much, Dr. Larson. I'd like to have an Elaine Larson lecture at the top of every teleclass schedule every year because it really starts things off right. Thank you very much for that.
Can you review again the enabling in your study, what you actually meant by enabling factors?
Yeah, I'm sorry. I kind of botched that one up a little bit. This framework, some of you may recognize, it's a very popular framework for health education. The enabling factors are, am I able to do what I'm told to do? So let me give you an example. Do I know how to use the alcohol hand rinse? Do I have the supplies there in order to use it? Do I have access? Those kinds of things. So it's skills kinds of things. The reinforcing factors have to do with, what do people that I value think? Are they going to reinforce this? If I do it and it actually has an outcome, that's reinforcing. Can I see that things are changing? Does that help?
That's very helpful. Thank you.
Sure. And actually, I recommend this model to any of you who are thinking about any kind of a health education intervention. It's a terrific model, and it's by Green. It's called, as you see, the Precede-Proceed model.
This is Elaine from Canada.
Yes, you
and are. I just want to commend you on the excellent presentation. It really hits the kinds of practices we are promoting in our communities, and the use of the model will enhance it even more. And we have a little bit more credibility with the research that you've provided to be able to go forth and reinforce, I guess, some of the methodologies. Thank you.
I appreciate it, because I worry that I'm not. I worry that it's like so basic. You know, and I know it is, but frankly, that's where we are.
I would like to ask a question about the time with hand washing, scrubbing. What is the recommended time?
Are you talking about in the community or
yes.
with healthcare people?
In general?
Well, it's quite different for the two. For hand washing in the community, the main purpose of hand washing is to remove transient flora, and 10 to 15 seconds is enough. And, you know, I'm sure you've heard the thing that we train kids to wash their hands by having them sing Happy Birthday. The food service industry has their own regulations, and I'm not informed enough. I might say something wrong, so I'm not really sure. I think I've seen something as high as 60 seconds, and quite frankly, that's totally impractical.
Yes.
But if it were me, I would recommend 15 to 30 seconds for hand washing. But for the alcohol hand rubs, if you put in 3 to 5 mils, you don't have to time anything. You just have to wait for it to dry and you're done.
That, of course, is the joy of those sanitizers. They have a built-in dwell time, right?
That's right.
My thanks to Marvin and Didier and David and all the folk at Deb Canada for their generous support of this teleclass. Thank you very much, Dr. Larson. A marvelous presentation today. And to all of you, I say again, thank you very much. And until we meet again, goodbye.